This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, you might be expecting an edition of The Briefing Room here, but I thought you might prefer to listen to me, Johnny Diamond, with the news review of the year.
The world has changed. None of us can go back. All we can do is our best. And sometimes the best that we can do is to start over.
And that's what we are doing on the news review of the year. Starting over at the end, looking back at the beginning, doing our best to make sense of a very changed world. With thanks to Avengers Endgame there. Not only my favourite film of the year, but the favourite film of all time when it comes to gross earnings. $2.8 billion so far. For the story of how the Avengers reacted to Thanos' use of the Infinity Gauntlet to kill half the universe. Joining me, Johnny Diamond, on this epic quest to understand and explain the recent past is a truly heroic gathering. In no particular order, Jennifer Williams, the award-winning political and investigations editor of the Manchester Evening News, here in a nod to the discovery of a place called the North by the Conservative Party. Rory Sutherland, vice chairman of the advertising agency Ogilvy, author, commentator and sometime cravat wearer, and Helen Lewis, staff writer at The Atlantic magazine and author of the soon-to-be-published Difficult Women, A History of Feminism in 11 Fights. Talking of fights, seconds out, round one, which of you saw Avengers Endgame? Helen?
I did see Avengers Endgame.
All of it?
I mean, I may have drifted off through the second, third and fourth hours, but it was, I think it's a brilliant metaphor for this year in politics, actually, which is that it went on for an incredibly long time. There were lots of characters I'd vaguely forgotten made a reappearance, and then the end was slightly disappointing.
OK, Rory, did you see Avengers Endgame?
No, I'm an extremely grumpy man on this kind of whole Marvel universe, which is I prefer my films to obey the laws of physics.
And narrative, perhaps.
Strangely, although my tastes are very, very mainstream in things like food and other forms of entertainment. In film, I'm a kind of French art house man.
Excellent.
All that sort of stuff has entirely passed me by.
Okay.
I occasionally drive my children to see it. That's as much as I'll do.
Jen, did you see Avengers Endgame?
I didn't. I think I've got a bit lazy on cinema. I think I've ended up getting sucked into kind of sitting watching Netflix.
On the sofa.
Yeah, and also Avengers in my head is John Steed and Diana Rigg, really.
Different world.
Just different
world.
Thing. Yeah.
Give me, if you would, your one story of the year that caught your eye. Jen?
Well, I'm going to be very self-indulgent and talk about something that we covered at the end of May, which was a report by the UK 2070 Commission, which is headed up by Lord Bob Kerslake. And they looked back 40 years to look at how this country has become more and more kind of regionally unequal. And then they looked ahead 40 years to talk about, you know, what structurally do we need to do? And off the back of that, all the Northern newspapers, actually, we launched a campaign around it calling for certain things that it had highlighted. But aside from plugging that campaign, the reason that I'm highlighting it is because a lot of the stuff that it was talking about then kind of came in as themes in the general election.
Helen, your story of the year.
The unfortunate deaths of 51 people in New Zealand in Christchurch in May. And it was a fascinating story for a number of different reasons, all related to things that I've covered now at The Atlantic and previously at The New Statesman. What happened was that the shooter posted a manifesto on several online sites and mailed it to the Prime Minister, talking about this online conspiracy, far-right conspiracy theory about the Great Replacement, which is essentially the idea that Muslim populations are having more children than white European populations. You know, there is a kind of genocide of white people going on, which is a very unpleasant and very powerful awful thing that is circulating across a number of different far-right communities online. But also the reaction of Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister, who said, I'm never going to say the name of the shooter, which is something that's come up again and again in spree killings in America, and I think in terrorist acts here, about, you know, it happened in the London Bridge attack. We want to focus on the people who do brilliant things in the aftermath. We don't want to focus on the act. We want to focus on the reaction. Mm. And I think that provides a really useful way of thinking about horrible acts of violence. Let's look at all the people who help in the aftermath. You know, let's look at all the people who are genuinely nice to each other.
Rory, you have a niche story of the
Well, actually, I've don't you? Changed my mind.
Oh, you can't do that. You can do whatever you want.
Because it's a real curveball for you, which is a paper recently published in Nature Physics, which is the paper for physicists who find nature far too mainstream for them. And it's written by Ole Peters, and it's about the question of ergodicity in economics. Now, I'm not going to attempt to explain this in full detail, but what I do suggest you do is go online and search for ergodicity.
Okay.
And in particular, ergodicity economics. And what he's essentially suggesting as a physicist is that the whole discipline of economics missed a distinction which was spotted by physicists in the 1840s. Someone like Boltzmann, I think, spotted the fact that the time series outcome isn't the same as an ensemble average.
Okay.
Now,
Rory, you're going to have to tell me what that means.
Let me tell a very simple example of this. One of the strangest examples of media bias over the last 20 years, 30 years really, was that rising house prices were always looked at as a good news story. Why? Because on average, wealth was increasing. Now, if you look at that as a simple snapshot, on average, the population are getting richer, therefore that's good news. If you look at it through the eyes of a single individual over time, most of your adult life is spent either trying to buy your first house or trying to buy a slightly bigger house than your last house, which means that actually you want prices to remain fairly stable, even to fall a little bit without getting into negative equity. Yeah. It's only to a very, very select group of people, people planning to downsize at the end of their lives, for whom rising house prices are genuinely good news. Now, I would argue that everybody got this wrong. They portrayed as what was good on average overall as therefore being good for everybody.
Does your news story of the year effectively undermine the basis of economics as we've understood it for decades? Is that what you're saying?
It requires a fairly significant rethink. Yeah. I think that's fair to say. I also see this as the opportunity that with better economics to begin with, actually, I think it's very creatively liberating.
Mm. Okay, let's move on for the moment. We will return to these big themes. We have lost many notable men and women this year, too many to mention in full, so apologies now for the inevitable omissions. Continuing our homage to the North, let's remember Albert Finney, who sprang from Salford, dazzled in both kitchen sink dramas and historical romps in the 60s, and stepped nimbly between stage and screen all his career. He was Hercule Poirot, he was King Lear, he was Erin Brockovich's feisty lawyer, and he was unmistakably and rather brilliantly Winston Churchill.
Look at it, Clemmy. Nowhere in the world could you find a landscape more ravishing than that. And it's ours to look at and to cherish for the rest of our lives. I would die for it, Clemmy.
Farewell, Albert Finney. Re-elected this December, the Right Honourable Member for Maidenhead, also known as the former Prime Minister, Theresa May. How she must have wished for an Avengers-style infinity gauntlet, as time and time again she was humiliated by her parliamentary party, by the Speaker, the opposition, and, of course, the one that broke her, the electorate. In June sunshine, but close to tears in Downing Street, she announced her departure.
I will shortly leave the job that it has been the honour of my life to hold. The second female Prime Minister, but certainly not the last. I do so with no ill will, but with enormous and enduring gratitude to have had the opportunity to serve the country I love.
But Theresa May's departure did not ease the deadlock. Parliament and the executive were at loggerheads, each claiming to speak for the country, when Boris Johnson suspended Parliament for more than 5 weeks ahead of the latest deadline for departure from the EU, there was constitutional outrage. Royal prerogative was thought to be pretty much untouchable, but someone forgot to tell the Supreme Court, which struck down the suspension. Lady Hale, the president of the court, and her spider brooch became an overnight, if rather unlikely, sensation.
The Prime Minister's advice to Her Majesty was unlawful, void, and of no effect. This means that the order in council to which it led was also unlawful, void, and of no effect, and should be quashed. This means that when the Royal Commissioners walked into the House of Lords, it was as if they had walked in with a blank sheet of paper.
Alongside this unprecedented judicial intervention into the powers of the executive, we thought we saw the crumbling of a pillar of British political life, the two-party system, as MPs from left and right deserted their parties to snuggle into the centre ground. But come election time, the great squeeze began, and not one of those who fled the nest was returned to Parliament. After a decade of wafer-thin or non-existent majorities, it was the 80s all over again.
Ian Levy, the Conservative Party candidate, 17,000.
The Tories swept to victory with an 80-seat majority. Becoming world king, a childhood ambition, may have to wait, but Downing Street is Boris Johnson's to enjoy for the foreseeable future. Written off after a shaky time at the Foreign Office, Mr. Johnson convinced his colleagues in Parliament that only he could save them, and then convinced the electorate that only he could, yes, wait for it, get Brexit done. In victory, Mr. Johnson displayed, if not magnanimity, then a good dose of humility.
In this moment of national resolution, I want to speak directly to those who made it possible, and to all those who voted for us for the first time, and those whose pencils may have wavered over the ballot, and who heard the voices of their parents and their grandparents whispering anxiously in their ears. I say thank you for the trust you have placed in us and in me, and we will work round the clock to repay your trust and to deliver on your priorities with a Parliament that works for you.
I think it's pretty inevitable that the first grown-up discussion we have of the show is going to be about politics. What an astonishing year. Can I start with centrism and its failure? Because it did look, for a period, as MPs drifted away from their parties and as the parties seemed to break into different factions, that two-party politics was going to collapse. It doesn't appear to have. Rory, centrism hasn't happened.
No, it's very interesting. And the question why, I think, is incredibly complicated. It's never been a geographically widespread party, the Lib Dems. There's also a supreme irony, by the way, which is I think the problem with the Liberal Democratic Party isn't the party itself. I think it's the people who vote for it, who are actually remarkably fickle.
Right.
So a friend of mine pointed out something that had never occurred to me, which is that if the Liberal Democrat vote had actually held up for the what was effectively the second election with Cameron as Prime Minister, the Conservatives wouldn't have had a majority, you would have had another coalition, and there wouldn't have been a referendum in the first place. Yes. So their weird obsession with punishing Clegg for going into coalition had very strange unintended consequences. And it's a very interesting way of looking at it. I think my very cynical view, and it's not a very nice one, is that there was a large chunk of Liberal Democrat supporters who had always found it very convenient to support a party that was never in power, because you could always essentially say, don't blame me. And the second they actually had to take decisions because they were in coalition, those people somehow felt that the signalling value of being a Liberal Democrat had been destroyed and weirdly would happily vote for far-left candidates instead. So there was something going on there with that entire electorate which doesn't fully make sense.
Helen, did you think as various different MPs made their way towards the Independent Group or Change UK or whatever name it chose as the months went on and towards the Lib Dems, did you think something was shifting in the earth of British politics, or did you think the system would always snap back into a two-party system, for England at any rate?
I think those two things can exist at the same time, and I think it's really interesting to look at where the Tory party is now. You know, Boris Johnson went into this election with, yes, one big message about get Brexit done, but also I'm going to spend a lot more money on the NHS and I'm going to spend a lot more money on police. This is not a David Cameron, George Osborne austerity message that he's putting out. He's actually putting out in spending terms a much more left-wing message. So this is the problem with trying to define what centrism is and finding a load of policies that line up down it. Actually, the Tory party over its life has been extremely useful about picking things off the menu from other parties that look like they're working at the time and using it to win elections. But the problem for me, as ever, is the two-party system under First Past the Post. I mean, that's what crushed all of those independents. Someone like David Gawk ran a great campaign, got, I think, something like 15, 17,000 votes. But without that brand, that rosette on you, you start from such a disadvantage. And I think it's a shame, you know, the Lib Dems increased their vote in this election, but it's so inefficiently distributed. Those big parties will endure because they're the game in town if you want to get your candidates elected.
Unless you're geographically concentrated like the SNP, in which case you're slightly overrepresented.
And the SNP, I think, 30,000 votes for every SNP seat, whereas the Lib Dems, 300,000. You know, we're talking about orders of magnitude different about how many people you have to get to vote for you in order to result in one MP.
Yeah. I think what's kind of strange about it, but it does make sense, is that in the local and European elections, the two main parties got an absolute kicking from people. But 6 months later in the general election, going out and talking to people who were voting, number one, they hated the choice that they were being given. But number two, felt that if they voted for not one of those two parties, in many cases, that it was going to be a waste because they had to keep the other lot out or it was being framed around Brexit. And it was a very, in many respects, a very binary general election, a very presidential general election. People were talking about the two main leaders and they weren't talking about the more minor parties, even though 6 months earlier, people had been thinking of those terms because it was a different election. It was a different context.
And we saw, obviously, the Brexit Party go from winning the European elections to completely disappearing in the general election.
Yes, and I think if they hadn't stood against in some of those Labour seats, actually Labour would have suffered an even greater loss. So their main effect in standing in these elections was to protect Labour. So you can see why Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage probably won't be having a cordial supper anytime soon.
I mean, actually, we're slightly writing off the Brexit vote simply because there was a large Conservative majority. If you add up the Brexit plus Tory vote, places like Torvine in South Wales actually had more Brexit plus Conservative votes than Labour, which would have been completely unthinkable sort of 6 or 7 years ago.
But this was Boris Johnson's great success, though, wasn't it, in so many respects? You know, he's created a new coalition of voters. And on the one hand, he's got the people who used to vote Brexit Party. But on the other hand, as you say, he is appealing to, you know, what in some respects, in Conservative terms, is fairly left-wing politics. And certainly if you're going to talk about what will Jeremy Corbyn's legacy be, aside from whatever happens to the Labour Party, I think that Labour probably did help to pull that centre of gravity to the left for the Conservative Party. And I think Boris Johnson knew that if he was going to win votes in some of these formerly Labour heartland seats, that he was going to obviously need a clear message on Brexit, which he had, but then the rest of it was going to need to talk to that kind of more centre-ground public services. If you actually look at what he was saying, there wasn't an awful lot of meat on the bones. You know, he was saying, we're going to replace the police officers that we've cut over the last 10 years, slightly vague promises about hospitals, but it was enough.
It is very, very interesting how confused this is in many ways. I mean, in a way, I fell asleep for election night before the exit poll and I woke up and I had the strange experience where just when you thought it couldn't go any worse for the Labour Party, they won Putney.
Yes.
And that was almost an additional embarrassment. That was adding insult to injury because that claim that they'd actually lost touch with the North, they'd lost touch with their traditional heartlands, was almost reinforced by the fact that their only win was an extremely wealthy London seat. Yeah.
Let's step back, if we can, from the Labour and the Conservative tussle, because we heard earlier from Brenda Hale, Lady Hale, President of the Supreme Court. And if anything, this year has been this astonishing tussle between the institutions of the country and also, in some eyes, a trampling on precedent, which is the thing which sort of governs the country in many ways because of our largely unwritten constitution. There seem to be two theories about our institutions. One is that our magnificent unwritten constitution has bent beautifully in the winds over the last year and it now springs back. The other is that so much precedent has been trampled upon that irreparable harm has been done to the institutions of the country. Helen, what do you think? Where do you stand? Does the British system of government stand tall at the end of this year?
My colleague Tom McTague wrote a piece at The Atlantic saying, yeah, the constitution is being strained to its limits and that shows how it's working. That's what it's designed to do. And I think this period has been particularly challenging because you're trying to inject direct democracy in the form of a referendum into representative democracy, and the two systems do not work very well together. You have people in the Conservative Party who voted several times to block Brexit, even though they really, really love Brexit, which is a very odd thing to try and get your head around because they just didn't think the deal was hard enough. So those two things just don't jam together very well. But a lot of the stuff that has been the trampling on conventions and the kind of parliamentary shenanigans doesn't make any sense now. With a majority of 80, Boris Johnson can do more or less what he wants. Mm. So you won't get those kind of clashes about the parliamentary timetable, for example, that we've seen over the past year or so.
Yeah. Rory, were you at all concerned as the year went on that the institutions of the country were becoming strained and that this that the clash between them would damage the way that we govern ourselves?
I think what you might call the establishment behaved extraordinarily petulantly in response to the referendum.
Who do you mean by that?
It doesn't really matter who you mean by it in a way, because people use the phrase, you know, the elite, etc., to mean whatever it suits.
Some people said, oh, that's the Supreme Court at various points. You know, the Daily Mail, for example, had a full frontal on judges, didn't it?
Is Jacob Rees-Mogg the establishment in this scenario, or is he anti-establishment?
Well, the idea would be that you had a fairly clear vote where the promise was made clearly, OK? Now, you have a large number of people in the country who are tired of decisions being taken at two or three removes from their everyday lives. And to me, first of all, it wasn't that big a deal. Secondly, the fact that the establishment argued their case always on economic grounds, they suddenly became wildly excited by trade deals and multinational supply chains. Okay, people on the left who'd never shown the slightest interest in multinational supply chains for the last 15 years suddenly became passionately interested because they could use it as an argument against Brexit. And it was so obvious to anybody that their attachment to the European Union was emotional. It was a kind of fealty. And it was not an economic rational argument. And so you could accuse the Leave Brigade of having lied, and maybe they lied about some of the facts. I'd also say the Remainers were lying about their motivations. But nearly all the motivation was emotional, and it was kind of internationalist and cosmopolitan, and they pretended it was economic.
The argument the other way was emotional too, though, wasn't it? I mean, the vote was hugely emotional.
But I don't think Farage, for all his faults, would ever have denied that. Mm. I mean, he would say we have an emotional attachment because the very question of what you might call self-actualization and self-control, take back control, is an emotional argument.
The bit I would disagree with you on is the idea about that, you know, it was very clear what people voted on. I think from the fact that Jacob Rees-Mogg voted against the Brexit deal, it shows that there are enormous shades of what Brexit might look like. And it reminded me, we were talking last week about whether or not Scotland might now want another referendum. And it reminded me, covering that in 2014, that they put out a brochure that said, you know, Scotland's future, a heavy, great thing. I use it to kill spiders with now. But it was essentially a white paper from the government saying, this is what happens if we get independence. And I think we can have a discussion about whether or not we should ever have a referendum again. But if we do, we should definitely have it so that there is a document that says this is what happens if we change, because that will mean that we don't end up with 3 years like we've had where everybody argues about what actually Brexit means and you get Theresa May saying Brexit means Brexit.
Okay, let's leave the world of politics and look at some other news. In February, Shamima Begum, who had, along with two other teenagers, left London in 2015 so as to join Islamic State Group, was found in Al-Hol refugee camp in Syria. In a move that did not endear her to many, she defended the group's activities.
It's a two-way thing, really, because women and children are being killed back in the Islamic State right now. And it's kind of retaliation. Like, their justification was that it was retaliation, so I thought, OK, that is a fair justification.
She was stripped of her British citizenship, a move against which she is appealing.
It is clear that this is one of New Zealand's darkest days. Clearly, what has happened here is an extraordinary and unprecedented act of violence.
Jacinda Ardern, New Zealand's Prime Minister, speaking after, as Helen's already mentioned, far-right terrorism came to her country. Attacks in the city of Christchurch left 51 dead and 49 injured as a single gunman murdered worshippers in two mosques. On the Saturday before Easter in Sri Lanka, IS would claim responsibility for 8 bombings in churches and hotels. At least 280 people were killed, more than 500 injured. Until December this year, Britain appeared to escape from radicalised terror. Then at a meeting in London, Usman Khan killed two of those who spent their lives trying to help others. Jack Merritt and Saskia Jones were both part of the rehabilitation effort that Khan had taken advantage of so as to travel to the capital. In amidst the violence and the senseless death, there was heroism too. Commodore Toby Williamson runs the venue where the murders took place.
This is a guy called Lucas. Lucas pulls off the wall this long stick. He charges towards the bad guy and he impacts him on the chest. The door's opened, out the terrorist falls, and the first one after him is Lucas, shouting at everyone to get out of the way, get back. But I tell you what, members of the public, they just don't do that nowadays. They do what they needed to do. They join in, the man with the fire extinguisher, the man with an arm or tusk, they're all in there.
A reminder of the power of individuals in extraordinary times. You're listening to me, Johnny Diamond, with the Radio 4 News Review of the Year with Rory Sutherland, Helen Lewis and Jennifer Williams. It was a thrilling year in sport and in some surprising quarters too. The England women's football team stormed its way through to the semi-finals of the World Cup.
How about this? England in the World Cup semi-finals. Again, it's great to hear.
The team may have gone down to, of course, heroic defeat in the semi-finals, but the winner appeared to be the women's game. Viewing figures here and around the world marked something of a breakthrough. Talking of sport, let's remember a sporting life. Bob Willis was a right-handed fast bowler with a long, long run-up who set hearts racing one glorious summer back in 1981. In the second innings of the third test against the Aussies at Headingley, England faced near certain defeat. Australia, with 8 wickets in hand, needed a paltry 130 runs to win. Willis took wicket after wicket.
Here's Willis in, bowls to Bright. Bright bowled, the middle stumps out of the ground. England have won. They've won by 18 runs. Willis runs around, punching the air. Well, what a finish.
Bright for a new generation of cricket fans, this year's World Cup provided a stunning finish in a final that songs will be sung about for years to come. England and New Zealand had fought to a draw. Then came a super over when whoever scored the most runs from 6 balls would win. England scored 15. The Kiwis needed 2 off the last ball.
Archer bowls it. It's clipped away into the leg side. They're going to come back for the second. The throw is picked up. They throw to the wicketkeeper's end. He's run out, is he? I think he's run out. England think he's run out. England are convinced he's been run out. They're celebrating.
So much fun. Briefly, panel, did you join in the fun with the England victory, or was that just a slither of the population? Did it catch your imagination, Helen?
I actually flicked between that, and I think it was the Wimbledon final. And I thought, wow, someone's found a way to make cricket exciting. That clip that we played just then reminded me of my dad listening when we used to go on holidays to France to long wave radio, sitting in the car desperately trying to get a signal for hours on end. And I thought, what on earth is this game? But I think the really important thing about it, you mentioned the Women's World Cup there.
Yeah.
That being on terrestrial television was a massive deal for the women's game. And I think it's a story about how shameful it is that actually not all of sport is like that, because sports is so much, I'm not a massive sports fan, but it is so much about our national story and about people getting involved. And the story of women's football, you know, very popular during the First World War and then essentially crushed by the FA in 1921. It has taken a century to get back to where it is.
Mm. Rory, the 1981 Ashes or the victory this year in the Cricket World Cup, which one?
It makes no difference. The glorious thing about cricket, I think, is it's something a little like Anglicanism or baseball in the United States. I mean, the fact that it's so constant, that it's a kind of soundtrack to the summer in that way, makes it much more than just a sport. By the way, I mean, a lot of people criticise it for being boring. I always think the strength of baseball and cricket is precisely that they are sometimes boring. Yeah. I think that sports like football, where you are on a knife edge for the entire period of the game because you're always 15 seconds from disaster, strangely, I think they're missing something. I think the very fact that you have lulls is precisely what makes it beautiful.
Lovely. Yeah, I agree with that.
OK, there was another spanking for New Zealand, of course, in the Rugby World Cup when the English team overpowered the mighty All Blacks, only to be beaten in the final by South Africa. Let's have another life. Robert Mugabe was the world's oldest head of state before his ousting in 2017. He served 7 terms in office, an office that started at Zimbabwe's independence from Britain with the highest of hopes.
Our main concern should now be to join hands in building our country, so that we can create a new Zimbabwe with a new national faith, a new national love, binding all its people.
But Robert Mugabe thrived on intrigue and enmity, crushing political and ethnic rivals, journalists and critics, and finally driving white farmers from the land and his country into bankruptcy and hunger as he did so. "I will never, never surrender," he said. "Zimbabwe is mine." He left it in ruins. We also said goodbye to Jacques Chirac, two-term French president who enjoyed a 40-year career in French politics, perhaps best known not for undertaking urgently needed social and economic reforms, but instead energetically opposing the Iraq War. Let's have a quick-fire round. What is TikTok and do you use it? Rory.
It's a very strange Chinese-owned social media application.
Well done.
Which allows you to make short video clips, typically of yourself, strangely, with musical accompaniment. So the only way I can describe it is, if there were to be a TV sitcom made about you, TikTok would be the opening sequence of that programme.
Right, right.
And it is, as all things which my children use, completely baffling in its popularity.
Right, you've never used it yourself.
I've looked at it.
You've looked at it. All right, Helen.
No, I've never used it. I decided when I turned 35 that I was going to be able to bow out on age grounds of all new social networks. And I'm grateful not to have to know what TikTok is. Although I have seen other people use it. I understand it's very popular on the interwebs.
Very, very popular on the interweb, Jen.
I saw clips of it used during the election, which worried me because it did make me realise there was a whole generation of people out there doing things around politics that I just did not really know about, and no, I haven't used it.
Okay, I should say it has now been downloaded 1.5 billion times in total. You're listening to the News Review of the Year with Helen Lewis, Rory Sutherland and Jennifer Williams. Let's look abroad. Much of the year has been bound together by this sound. From Chile to Algeria, Hong Kong to Lebanon, the street is where it's been at these past 12 months. A bubbling stew of disaffection, new forms of organisation, round after round of tear gas, or in the case of Iraq and Iran, live ammunition. What, if anything, has bound this astonishing string of protests together, do you think, Jen?
I wouldn't say that it binds together every single one of them, but I think it's interesting how many cases the trigger factor was rising fuel prices. Mm. You know, the flip side to that is the climate change protests in this country.
Which we'll come to.
Yeah. But there are some long-term kind of globally structural problems which are now starting to surface in these kinds of protests. So in the case of fuel prices and the protests that sparked in places like Iran and Ecuador. But equally, you've also got ageing populations having an impact as well. So in France, these continual protests around pension reforms, which obviously we've seen before and the government has failed in the past to do it, and now they're trying it again. But I mean, in this country, we've had the WASPI women protest, which obviously has been less disruptive, but they're all part of kind of global trends, which so far systems have not yet found a way of solving. And that is starting to kind of erupt, I think, in a lot of places, both in the West and elsewhere.
The Gilets Jaunes protests in France are an interesting outlier because the demographic of the protesters is much older. And one of the things that links these together, and indeed all uprisings, is youth movements, particularly youth unemployment. And David Runciman writes in his book about democracy that you would have expected much bigger protests, for example, in southern European economies at the times when they were in real trouble during the Eurozone crisis. But actually, young people tended to live with their parents or grandparents, and that kind of contained them slightly. But if you look at the protests in the Middle East, these are about young people who feel they don't really have anything to lose. They don't feel that there is a promise to them about what their lives could become. And the protests in Hong Kong are also really interesting because it is people who have grown up in a place that is halfway between the West and the East, and they want to stay part of the West. They don't want to come under Chinese law and Chinese state repression. And I think that's very interesting too. And again, as it comes into the climate strikes as well, that grew out of school strikes, that young people are driving these protests almost everywhere with the exception of France.
Rory, has your imagination been caught by them? And have you seen a thread that runs between them? Or do you think they're too disparate?
I think it's fairly disparate for the most part. In France, it's a kind of national tradition. You have this concept of the acquis, which is an acquired right. And if the government ever attempts to kind of tamper with one of those things that you see as a kind of acquired concession, it's mandatory that you go on the streets. Mm. The Gilets Jaunes things weren't entirely clear in what their motivation was. This more recent bout of protest against pension reform, I think, at least is slightly clearer. I'm slightly unnerved in the UK in that I think you should reserve this kind of behaviour for very, very serious disquiet for very large numbers of people. It's very difficult on television to convey the difference between a protest of 5,000 people and a protest of 200,000. And I think it's also worth remembering that it's disproportionately easy to participate if you're in London.
Sure.
And I also think it's disproportionately easy to participate if you haven't got a job. So I don't like the casual use of protest. I obviously defend the right of people to engage in it. But I think to some extent, if we're not careful, media will feed this as a kind of borderline PR stunt.
What we have seen abroad in various places, we mentioned Hong Kong, have been astonishing numbers turning out. I mean, I think at one point it was pretty much a fifth of the population on a weekend when they weren't expected to be at work, turning out. And there seems to be the starkest illustration, perhaps, feel free to disagree, where the street is jumping ahead of institutions that cannot deal with the demands of those that want to push things forward or change the way the world is. And again, in South America, we've seen a huge string of protests, which have not been just disproportionately based in capitals, but have been based, as you mentioned, Jen, on standard of living issues.
But I think there's a slight irony here, isn't there, that we talked about democratic institutions earlier on and almost kind of becoming slightly complacent about the strength of the institutions that make your country a democracy. In Hong Kong, the people protesting there are absolutely desperate to hold on to the democratic rights that they've had. And in other parts of the West, people are protesting because they feel that the democracy that they've got isn't working in the way that they thought that it ought to. And I've kind of been wondering a little bit about whether there's anything at all in the sense that, not in terms of the Hong Kong protests, but in the West, that what the internet era has slightly done is provided a kind of much faster gratification and a much quicker kind of cause and effect when you're trying to kind of whatever it is you might be immediately trying to get online. And democracy doesn't work like that. Democracy is slow. It rolls really slowly, and people are looking at it and thinking, well, I've not got what I want out of this democracy. But a lot of us won't, because democracy is compromise.
Yeah. Rory.
That's actually a very interesting point, which is whether in the West, essentially, we've been spoiled by online services to expect instantaneous reaction to our every whim. We can vote for, you know, dancing competitions and everything else. But there is a wider problem in protests, which is to demonstrate your solidarity to a group. You are often forced to engage in more and more extreme behaviour, face painting, for example,
extraordinary behaviour, Rory.
Okay, no. But that makes the protest, if you think about it, it makes the protest self-defeating, because people watching you on television look at you and think you're weird.
But you mentioned that we've talked about how disparate these global protests have been. The environmental protests this year do appear to have changed people's attitudes, or at least some people's attitudes, pretty significantly, to have shifted the dial. And leading the charge on that was a rather unlikely figure of a 16-year-old girl, Greta Thunberg, spurred on by the science of climate change and all these extraordinary weather events that have been occurring with increasing frequency.
How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. You are failing us. But the young people are starting to understand your betrayal. The eyes of all future generations are upon you.
Well, we saw Extinction Rebellion protests bring central London to a halt and then spread to other cities as well. And it did seem to either coincide or act as a catalyst towards a real change of mind. Or is that an imagination, Helen?
Protest movements always have to deal with the fact that what gets you the most attention also alienates some people and slightly...
Rory, always.
the face
Any crowd, basically, is alienating.
But, you know, I've spent the last couple of years writing about the suffragettes and the suffragists, really interesting division between the militant suffragettes and the law-abiding suffragists. And there's a brilliant bit that Millicent Fawcett, who was one of the law-abiding ones, writes in her memoir of the 1920s of being a dinner party, and a man saying to her, you know, all these incredibly militant tactics have really put me off supporting the vote for women. And she says, you know, at that point I asked him, until that point, what had he done to support the vote for women?
Yeah.
And she makes the very good point that, you know, she and the suffragists had been politely ignored. The suffragettes were thunderously condemned. And actually so much of how politics works is by that kind of dialectic of one side against another side and people feeling that there is a fight that they can take part in. And Greta Thunberg versus Donald Trump just is a very clarifying, defining sight. People feel they are very much on one side or another of that.
On the Extinction Rebellion protests, I think, on the one hand, there is a danger that it looks like the kind of movement that is sort of very North London, very sort of student-dominated, very, very middle class, kind of like all the stuff that, you know, the Labour Party has been criticised for during the election campaign. But on the other hand, I think they've been very successful at helping to get this firmly onto the political agenda. I think Greta Thunberg arguably was more the case in managing to do that. And it was slightly sickening slash hilarious to see kind of Michael Gove and various ministers sort of falling over themselves to go and almost compete to meet her when she was in this country, considering that so little had really been said about it in reality prior to that. It's been underneath the surface, but it has not been top of the agenda in any way. And then suddenly it's like a lid's been ripped off it really quite recently, I think, in terms of, you know, every kind of party is acknowledging now that's like something actually quite urgent needs to be done about it.
The only thing is, I mean, I always worry in politics that people effectively fall back on a heuristic, which is, I know I'm doing something right when I'm annoying people I don't like. Now, in the climate debate, I think there are solutions which would have broad consensus appeal, like rewilding and reforesting, for example. And I don't think they get the attention they deserve because people are much, much keener to essentially engage in behaviours or indeed to propose activities which annoy people on the opposite side.
Rory, I love that you're against face painting, but pro introducing wolves back to Britain.
Yes, okay. No.
We're going to leave it on that.
I was told yesterday actually by a bioconservationist that wolves are actually second best. Lynxes are better, but I'll settle for lynx.
Okay,
lynxes.
We'll settle for lynx for the moment. Yep. In April, a cultural catastrophe. The Cathedral of Notre Dame ablaze, the legendary spire and much of the roof did not survive. This year saw the departure of a company that had organised so many departures itself, Thomas Cook, which started as an organiser of trips for teetotalers and grew into a pillar of British life, threw in the beach towel. Just as Thomas Cook disappeared into the black hole of bankruptcy, scientists worked out how to observe the previously unobservable by combining dozens of radio telescope dishes at 8 observatories. An image of a black hole 53 million light years away was established. And some good news emerged from the fight with the Ebola virus, which reared up again in the Democratic Republic of Congo. 2 drugs tested this year showed dramatic improvements in patients' life chances. Let's celebrate that with another life. Edwin Bramall was 21 years old when he played his part in the D-Day landings, the 75th anniversary of which were commemorated this year. He later spoke of what he saw that day.
Congestion and chaos on the beaches, driving inland into the lush Normandy countryside, and then the appalling sights and sounds of war, the destroying villages, the dead cattle, the corpses, all the paraphernalia of war. And of course, one remembers all this. I mean, it was quite intense.
He would dedicate his life to the defence of his country, awarded the Military Cross, a member of the Order of the Garter and the Order of the Bath. He was falsely accused of child sexual abuse, for which he received an apology from the Metropolitan Police. He said he had never been as wounded by anything in the military as those allegations. Farewell, Field Marshal Lord Bramall. This year we said goodbye to one of the great stars of the 50s and 60s, the singer and actor Doris Day. The star of Calamity Jane and Pillow Talk performed in dozens of romantic comedies with a voice and a smile shot through with sunshine.
I love you, a bushel and a peck, a bushel and a peck, and a hug around the neck.
Farewell, Doris Day. Clive James made his name as a poet, an essayist and a broadcaster. He took TV seriously before anyone else bothered, exulting in the spectacle of strange that could be found inside the magic lantern. But there was a lot more than TV clips and quick quips to his fast and restless mind.
The Shakespeare of Russia was, or was going to be, Alexander Pushkin, a divinely gifted poet who died young, and mainly from his own folly. But he was one of those foolish young men who have wisdom as a gift to squander, and he said a marvellous thing about children. They crowd us from the world. If he had lived long enough, eventually they would have done that to him. It's why children are here, to replace us. If we're lucky, we've grown old enough to need replacement.
Farewell, Clive James. Quickfire round. How many years was it between Clive James saying he was going to die and actually doing the decent thing and dying? Helen?
It must have been at about 8, I think.
8 years. Rory?
I think it was about 7 or 8.
7 or 8?
I would say 10.
You'd say 10. I'll give it to Rory. It was just about 7 years.
He wrote a poem about a Japanese maple.
That's right, 2014.
The fact that he'd never see it.
That's
in colour
he
again.
He actually apologised for being alive, I think, in late 2015. Felt rather embarrassed about it.
The best first line of a Clive James poem is, "The book of my enemy has been remaindered, and I am glad."
Yes.
It's the ultimate Schadenfreude poem.
Okay. You wait years for a good royal interview, and then guess what? They all come at once. The Windsors poured out their pain or proclaimed their innocence in interviews with ITV and the BBC. First up were Harry and Meghan, who appear to be having a terrible time of it. Harry told ITV's Tom Bradby how much he hated those who followed his every public move. Full disclosure, my day job is as a royal correspondent. And Harry talked of how his mental health is a continuing struggle and how things between him and his brother have changed.
We're certainly on different paths at the moment, but I will always be there for him, and as I know he'll always be there for me. We don't see each other as much as we used to because we're so busy, but you know, I love him dearly, and you know, the majority of the stuff is probably, well, the majority of stuff is created out of nothing, but you know, it's just, as I said, as brothers, you know, you have good days, you have bad days.
Meghan spoke of how her new life as a duchess was rather far from what it was cracked up to be.
I really tried to adopt this British sensibility of a stiff upper lip.
It has its advantages,
I guess.
I
really tried, but I think that what that does internally is probably really damaging. And the biggest thing that I know is that I never thought that this would be easy, but I thought it would be fair.
As accusation followed insinuation over Prince Andrew's relationship with the deceased sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and the photograph of the prince with the then 17-year-old Virginia Roberts, Prince Andrew made the, with hindsight, disastrous decision to clear the air once and for all by talking it through with the notoriously easygoing and sympathetic Emily Maitlis of Newsnight. She took him through the accusations.
She says she met you in 2001. She says she dined with you, danced with you at Tramp nightclub in London. She went on to have sex with you in a house in Belgravia belonging to Ghislaine Maxwell, your friend. Your response?
I have no recollection of ever meeting this lady. None whatsoever.
He tried to explain that his visit to see Epstein in 2010 to tell him the prince said that their friendship was over was driven by the highest motives.
I've gone through this in my mind so many times. At the end of the day, with the benefit of all the hindsight that one can have, it was definitely the wrong thing to do. But at the time, I felt it was the honourable and right thing to do.
And in a strong bid for the Out of Touch Award for 2019, Prince Andrew gave us a glimpse into the life of royalty.
Am I right in thinking you threw a birthday party for Epstein's girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell, at Sandringham?
No, it was a shooting weekend.
A shooting weekend.
Just a straightforward shooting weekend.
Straightforward shooting weekend. And so the royal family ended up just where it never wants to be, on the front pages in the middle of an election and a point of discussion in the first debate between Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn.
Is the monarchy fit for purpose? Jeremy Corbyn.
Needs a bit of improvement.
It was, said the Queen in her Christmas broadcast, if not a bum year, then a bumpy one. Crises come and go for the royal family. This felt at times like a very serious moment when you had Harry and Meghan saying essentially they hated their jobs, and you have Prince Andrew, to put it politely, being put into forced retirement. Was this an important moment for the institution, Helen?
I think it's part of an ongoing process of slimming down the monarchy, which has been going on really for 2 decades now, and, you know, slimming down what used to be called the civil list. I think one of the most significant things that happened this year is baby Archie was born didn't end up getting any royal titles.
Harry and Meghan's child, yeah.
Yeah. And there is an assumption that actually there's a kind of core firm who have ceremonial roles and duties, and actually everybody apart from them should slightly fade into the background. And I think the idea of Prince Andrew's trade envoy role, which he had to give up years ago when these allegations first surfaced, that is simply unsustainable, that there is no role really for members of the royal family to sort of jet around with slightly sleazy people, with oligarchs, to take huge amounts of hospitality from strange Central Asian dictatorships. And actually they should focus, it's going to sound very patronising, they should focus on the sort of ribbon cutting and the investitures and the stuff that only they can do. And actually they don't get to be kind of global playboys. But the idea that we hate the royal family for being out of touch is sort of fundamentally hilarious to me. These are people, aristocrats descended because of their magic blood, who live in castles. And the idea that they're going to be on TikTok is kind of absurd to me.
Kind of the point of them is that they're out of touch, isn't it? I mean, that's kind of partly where they derive their glamour. I mean, you look, the royal family's been through this kind of scale of crisis before, hasn't it, in the 90s? And then it kind of went through a period of regeneration.
Yeah.
And I think the royal family are going to have to go through a pretty major change fairly soon. Anyway,
but you don't think that what came out this year was a part of that change?
Yeah, I do. I do think it was part of that change. But I think it didn't necessarily have to quite be like that, because Prince Andrew didn't have to make such an extraordinary PR gaffe out of it. I mean, he brought some of that on himself.
Rory.
I mean, in defence of Andrew, which is a sentence you won't hear anywhere else on radio, far, far brighter people than him who should have known better in the US academic fraternity were kind of duped by Epstein. Particularly in the field of sort of evolutionary thought, immensely eminent academics who, when asked, would you like to go on a private jet and go to an island? We can kind of forgive them for saying yes, but they ought to have asked some tougher questions.
The spotlight, because of that 40-minute interview, falls perhaps most heavily on Prince Andrew. But let's go back to that Harry and Meghan interview, where they made clear in public how much they effectively disliked what they had to do. They disliked their jobs. To me, that was a real novelty, to have members of the royal family saying, we don't enjoy our lives.
Yes, very far from the late Queen Mother's never complain, never explain, yeah, and much more in tune with the public mood of being much more into sharing. I mean, one of the defining memories of the 90s, I think, for a lot of us is watching young Princes William and Harry walking behind their mother's coffin at, you know, I was around the same age, thinking that this would not have been a thing that I could possibly have ever done, with that, trying to deal with a private grief with that level of public attention on you seems in retrospect an incredibly cruel thing to put them through. And I think that experience and its aftermath deeply, deeply scarred Prince Harry. He's talked about it. But I think it's very difficult for them to be ambassadors of mental health things. I wrote about this in relation to Meghan Markle guest editing Vogue magazine this year. What they can do is say, we should all talk more about mental health. What they can't ever talk about are policy solutions or NHS funding or anything that has any political overtone that appears to criticise the government. So it all ends up in this strange apolitical zone where the answer to everything is talking about it more. And you know what? If you've got schizophrenia, talking about it does not help you an enormous amount. Actually, what you need is treatment and support. And I think it's a really difficult thing. We want the royals to be more empathetic, but there are very hard limits on what they can do when they have to stay away from capital P politics.
Okay.
I mean, one of the things, of course, which Meghan possibly failed to notice or nobody warned her of, is that the deference paid to Hollywood celebrities in the United States is an order of magnitude greater, strangely, than the deference we pay to our royal family. We kind of build them up, knock them down, almost as a whim. The other thing I think you've got to remember is that we don't mind the royal family being privileged or rich, but we don't particularly like to see them enjoying themselves in ways that we might like to enjoy ourselves. So it's perfectly fine if you stand in the mud in cold weather and shoot at things, because most of us don't have any urge to do that. When you start flying by private jet, that's when it gets actually awkward.
Huh.
And there was always that very delicate thing, which is you'd have a royal train or you'd travel through on aging RAF aircraft. And that was kind of okay. When it's Elton's Gulfstream, it's slightly different.
I think there's also a kind of the hypocrisy thing that creeps in sometimes that people don't like as well, isn't there? So like if they feel like they're being lectured to about climate change, but also you're going off on your private jet, that's a kind of trap that they can fall into.
And weirdly, the Americans let Hollywood stars get away with that hypocrisy.
Yeah.
To an extraordinary extent. You know, if you think about it, the carbon footprint of a Hollywood A-lister is absolutely colossal. And yet, for some reason, they're allowed to make those platitudinous statements.
Let us have another death. Andre Previn was not just a pianist, a composer, an arranger of music, a conductor. He was also a man who, with his charisma and telegenic personality, popularised the world of classical music. He won 4 Oscars, 11 Grammys, and spent many happy years with the London Symphony Orchestra, enjoying the way his life and art combined here.
I think that there is a whole side of English music that is enhanced by life here, whether it's the sea with Britain or the kind of rolling hills for Vaughan Williams or the bustle for Walton or whatever. It's very indigenous to this country. And I had always liked the music. I liked the music and admired it and studied it long before I ever came here.
Farewell, Andre Previn. Right at the end of the year, when most people were thinking about how they would deal with their visiting relatives, the House of Representatives impeached the US President, Donald Trump, the third time in the history of the Republic that such a thing has happened. It found that the President was guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors when he linked military aid to Ukraine and a White House meeting for the Ukrainian President to that country launching an investigation into the son of a political rival.
Wrong. What impeachment might have on your legacy?
No, not at all. It's a hoax. It's a hoax. It's a big fat hoax.
The impeachment now moves to a full trial in the Senate, which is expected to vote it down. Briefly, this would have been an enormous story just a few years ago. Now, it's something we almost expect. Do you think that the extraordinary has now become some way normalised in our discourse? Have things changed like that?
I remember when Barack Obama, one of the big scandals, he'd worn a tan suit. And then there was another one where he'd leaned over a lunch counter, which had got a glass partition, and it was the sort of spit guard. And everyone was like, food hygiene is appalling. And you think, wow, what a kind of simpler time it was then. But what's happened in America is very distinctive from what's happened here, I think, which is that the Republican Party has just gone off in a particular direction and there is an asymmetry in bending of the rules. I'm sure the Democrats do stuff in the normal course of politics, but they are kind of essentially normal centre-right party. The Republicans have drifted off. And you know what? They feel that they've got such a connection with their base. This happens with sectarian parties in places that are more religiously dominated, that they can't lose that. So they have actually ended up becoming more badly behaved. And I think that's something that, as political polarisation drives bad behaviour by parties, because if it's not, there aren't swing voters in the middle, then actually, you know, you've got your base, your Senate, and those people over there are bad people and you can never join them. It's not a check on political parties in the way that it was.
I think the thing you were saying about the Republicans I think is interesting, because essentially the Republicans have had to tie themselves to Donald Trump and they are terrified because their power derives from Donald Trump, this weird kind of appeal that Donald Trump has got. So they have to kind of buy into this madness. And I think I'm kind of vaguely optimistic that this kind of extraordinary being normalised is kind of slightly limited to Donald Trump, and that doesn't end up being a pattern that can perhaps continues here.
OK, with that, we come perilously close to the end of this review of the year. We will close with a salute to the soprano, Jessie Norman. Her voice, said one critic, was a grand mansion of sound, with sunlit rooms, narrow passages and cavernous halls, a metaphor to reflect the breathtaking range and versatility of this wonderful singer. My thanks to an equally wonderful panel, Jennifer Williams, Helen Lewis, Rory Southern. It really has been a great pleasure. Thank you. And I'll leave you and 2019 with Jessie Norman. Farewell, and may she rest in peace. I hope you all have a very fine new year.
Than when we first began.
That was the news review of the year with me, Johnny Diamond, produced by Sheila Cook.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.